Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests who are both experiencers and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. You're more than welcome to ring in during the show to make comments or ask questions. And also, I would like to encourage you to please check out our websites, towardthelight.org and towardthelight.info. We offer a myriad of services and support related to near-death experiences. And we also would like to encourage you to please make a donation to Toward the Light to support this wonderful program you're listening to and the myriad of free services that we do offer through our organization, Toward the Light. This week, I'm very pleased to have someone who's had a number of after-death communications, or as we say, ADCs, and he's the author of a most wonderful, marvelous book. I adore the title. It is called Drunk with Wonder. So just imagine that for a minute, and let us welcome to Toward the Light, Mr. Steve Riles. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Juliet. How are you today?
Oh, doing wonderful, and it's so nice to have you on. I've really been looking forward to this. I was so much enjoying reading your book last night and jumping up and down like an excited child as I was reading it. You've got so much wonderful wisdom in there, and goodness me, the tremendous trials that you went through that kind of catapulted you into this tremendous wisdom. So why don't we start by letting you share with our listening audience some of the experiences that you went through. You were a part of the, what do they call that? The Haight-Ashbury sort of historical events of San Francisco and all of that.
Yes, I was an official hippie. And had my card and everything. This is a joke, of course. If you burned your draft card, I guess you're an official hippie. So, I was actually too early. I was 17 the year that I was mostly in the Haight, the spring of 67. And I was going through a really rough patch with my family, my parents, my dad especially. And I, as many people have found, I found solace in the drugs. I wasn't doing alcohol at the time.
But I found at 17.
At 17, I had yet to get into alcohol, but I was I had discovered marijuana at just basically my 16th birthday and just trotted down the line pretty quick towards more and more intense substances. I was already taking a lot of LSD. And on this particular day in the spring of 67, I had gone up to the Haight. I'd been living in Hollywood after I'd left home after more altercations with my father. And
where was home, quote, quote?
Home was in Southern California.
Oh, Southern California. Okay.
And so on this particular day, I had gone up for a huge peace rally against the Vietnam War. And I think it must have been 50,000 people marching or something, and had been participating in that. And I don't remember now how I got involved with some people. We went to a crash pad, and the next thing I knew, I was watching some guys shoot methadrine, which is speed, which is still, unfortunately, a great scourge on our land. And for some reason, I thought that was cool. The truth is, I threw up the first time I watched somebody shoot. But by a couple hours later, I was having somebody do it to me, and off I went. You know, this whole business of drugs and alcohol and all of these addictions, I teach, and many others also, of course, teach that these are all symptoms of an underlying issue. And so I was, you know, I had been addicted to cigarettes from the age of 13, and was happy, or thought I was happy to be addicted, or I didn't even care about addiction. I just cared not to feel so much pain and anguish and loneliness, which is was a lot of my life before then. So there I went, Juliet. I started shooting drugs, and I went way off the deep end. I wound up shooting LSD and going and listening to the Doors, dancing to the Doors all night. And, you know, that was my hippie life. And for the next year, I was in and out of what we call speed runs, where I'd be up for three days or so at a time, and then come down and try to figure out what I was doing and who I was and where I was going to go and what crash pad I was going to go in, and I need to go out and panhandle some money so I could buy more drugs, buy some food. I was in and out of that kind of thing, and the following spring I wound up in Riverside, California, and was living in another crash pad, and just got in with these guys again who were shooting drugs, and that's pretty much all we did.
I've really got to admit my ignorance. I never even knew that there was such a thing as shooting LSD, but I'm an oddball of sorts, I guess, because I was never a druggie. So it's so interesting to learn about this, and I just feel utter compassion. In fact, I've made it a note to let people know that it's not right to be judgmental or mean-spirited towards people who take drugs, because they wouldn't be taking them if there weren't some reason or cause for them to resort to that. Not that it's the right choice, but that, you know, people do need to look deeper and understand that there is a reason that, unfortunately, people have resorted to these substances.
I couldn't agree more. I've never have run into anybody who I've been able to have a quality, deep conversation with who was addicted to something, who didn't have, you know, some really horrifying stories. One of the statistics that I find so sad is that as many as half of the people who are labeled as homeless or unsheltered in this country are Vietnam veterans.
Oh, gosh. That's a good point to make. I was concerned about that. And then what about the poor souls who do come back intact from the wars going on right now?
Well, that's it. We're quickly developing a whole new generation of people who, unless they're treated and met with a lot more love and understanding and compassion and tools, are going to be the next generation of homeless people. Because it's hard for people who haven't had those kinds of experiences to imagine what it's like to be so profoundly traumatized.
Oh, yes.
As having extreme violence all around you, or that you've committed yourself in the name of staying alive, or what have you. And so drugs and alcohol are great numbing agents. Alcohol in particular is, I found through lots of practice, is an amazingly effective numbing agent. I think it's the perfect drug for this country and for its willingness to have its head in the sand, frankly, a lot of the times, around the effect we're really having on each other and on the planet.
Well, notice how alcohol and cigarettes are so promoted and encouraged in this country.
Yeah, they're legal. They're taxed.
Yes. And that seems very daft to me.
Yes, and me too. And, you know, I spent 10 years smoking cigarettes and 33 years drinking, so I know whereof I speak in terms of my own personal experience and living in that world for a while. And so, to get back to my story, Juliet, I found myself on this April day of 1968, right after Martin Luther King had been assassinated, within days, in this crash pad, and I had just taken a very large hit of methadone in my vein, my left arm, and was lying there kind of gasping and having what they call tunnel vision, which is, you know, your heart starts beating about 200 beats a minute and you really, the vision starts narrowing down like you're in a tunnel or something. And I had convinced myself that was a good time. And I heard this voice, you know, it's a very familiar voice, like, "Steve, you know, what's the matter with you?" And kind of looked around and focused on this face, and it was one of my best friends, Carl, who I had been living with a few months before, but he'd had it with all my drugs and all the stuff I was doing, so he'd moved back in with his parents. And I hadn't seen him in a while, and I kind of realized, oh yeah, he was going to come out and visit. And what I was really surprised about was how angry he was with me. He was just furious. I realize now he was concerned about he was going to lose his friend, you know, that I was going to die on him. But that came out as anger, and the way he expressed it was I was just kind of lying there with my, you know, my mouth open and, you know, going through the breathing process and so on and being so stoned, and he dropped an 8-way LSD tablet down my throat.
What is that, if you don't mind translating again and speaking to somebody who's somewhat ignorant here?
Yeah, this was at the time it was called an 8-way purple Osley, and it was a guy named Osley made all of this really quality LSD back in the day. And an 8-way was something you literally could split in 8 into 8s, and each 8 would be a basic dose.
Wow. So you had an 8 dosages in one.
Right.
Oh, goodness me.
And his reaction was, this could kill you, it could cure you. Right now I don't much care which, you know, but I've had it, you know.
Now, I'm talking to a live human being. I'm not having an ADC now, am I?
Right. This is a live human being. And so...
Wow.
And so he just slammed the door and left.
Wow.
And I lay there, and I was, you know, just so rushing along on this methadrine that I, you know, I was just kind of, oh, wow. I wonder if that was really LSD. I wonder what will happen. And, you know, so I had taken so much. It wasn't a scary thing or anything. It was just... But pretty soon, I came on to this very strong LSD trip, and again, I was very familiar with it, so I was just flying around amongst the galaxies and so on, and as LSD users often do. And then at one point, I had what I had no idea for years afterwards, but had now come to realize I had a very clear out-of-body experience. I just found myself suddenly... kind of felt like I was kind of bumping along the ceiling, and I thought that was odd, and kind of felt like a balloon, and then I kind of imagined rolling over, and I looked down at myself, and, you know, Carl had told me that I was dying, that I was killing myself, and that I had to make a decision. Was I going to live or die? And so looking down at myself, I could see, here's this emaciated guy, you know, maybe 130 pounds, 6'2", and 130, and, you know, I wasn't clean, I wasn't, you know, just, I was just pretty sad. And I had this really intense revelation, you know, an epiphany, because I was, like, clear as still to this day, 40 years later almost, to say, God, Carl's right. I am going to die. And I guess I've been trying to kill myself. So am I going to die or am I going to live? Am I going to make a different choice? And the message that came back is, well, dying's easy. You know, if you want to live, you can live. You can live. You can go through, you can get through this and make a choice. And I made a very clear choice in that moment not to kill myself, to live. And I came down from that LSD trip and I packed up my stuff the next day. Called my mother and asked her to come get me, and I moved back home.
I want to back up a little bit, because when I was reading the intro to your book, you were talking about a voice speaking to you during this experience. And I'd like to address that, too, because I think that's really, really important.
Well, that's, yes, it was a very calm and clear and wise and loving voice, and that was the voice that said, you know, you've got a choice here. You can live or die. If you just keep going, you know, just shoot some more speed, and you will die. Or stop, and you will, and make some different choices, and you will live and have a, you know, have a life instead of not having a life. It's not too late, in other words. And this is a voice that, or an energy, or a consciousness that was very familiar to me from being on LSD. It was something I had access. And I didn't really know what it was or who it was. It's just that I had this, repeatedly had had this experience the previous year on an LSD trip in the Haight, for example. I found myself in what I later came to understand as the Akashic Records. And there was a place where to the in the process of formulating any question at all that I could possibly imagine asking, the answer was instantly available. So anyhow.
So did this happen just whilst you were on the LSD trip?
Yes.
Okay, so it's sort of like the LSD opened up that portal for you to hear that voice or to access it somehow.
Yes, and that's very common with people who take these substances.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be really clear, I'm not recommending that people do that. There are lots of other ways, much safer ways, to move into these levels of consciousness. And I've, in fact, spent a lot of time studying other ways to do this.
Oh, indeed.
But I want to be really authentic. I want
yes.
to be real with your listeners about what my experience was rather than trying to sugarcoat it or pretend it was something else.
That's what Toward the Light is all about. So thank you for that, and keep going. This is great.
Okay. Well, anyhow, it really was a major turning point. So I never shot speed again after that night. And I got back in touch with Carl, this friend, and he was really delighted to see me back home because we'd been friends at this high school that we've been going to in the same community. And we hung out a few times, and... I had gotten some trouble with the police, and so I had to go back out and have another court appearance or two in this town, and I got found not guilty in this particular situation. And on May 1st of 68, went home and then was going to go up to Carl's to celebrate my getting off and things really looking up. So I come walking into Carl's living room, and his home had been open to me. Became very close with his mom and his sister and so on, and so it was a kind of a community family gathering place for us guys, us people, us friends. And I walked in, and his sister, Michelle, Missy, had just said, something really bad has just happened. Not sure what it is, but there was this really... incredibly intense energy in the room, and I could see that Louise was on the phone, and then all of a sudden she just started screaming, and it was awful. I mean, it was the most heart-wrenching scream I had ever heard in my life. And the reason she had screamed is that a California Highway Patrol officer had just told her that her son had died in a motorcycle accident.
Oh, dear.
So I had this experience of having Carl, in essence, save my life, give me the opportunity to see that I had choices and that I could make a healthier one. And barely, maybe 3 weeks later, if that, he was dead.
Oh, my goodness me.
So I was... I mean, I was, you know, we were all, it was just awful. I mean.
I'm sure you had to be in a total state of shock as a result of that.
Yeah, in fact, I don't really remember much for several hours afterwards. I'm told that I was out wandering around where Carl and I used to go for walks in the woods and stuff, and down there in the hills above L.A., and I finally showed up sometime that evening at my house, and my mom took one look at me and said, "What on earth is the matter?" I said, "Carl,
well,
you know," so I went through that process as best as I could with no tools about how to deal with my emotions or my feelings. No real way to feel them in any healthy and appropriate way. And within, was on May 1st of 68, probably within 60 days, I had stayed away from booze up till that point. But that summer I was introduced to just how good a cold beer can taste on a hot day after pulling weeds, and so I discovered, you know, that I could really numb out my pain around Carl with beer. And on I went with my life. One of the really amazing miracles or gifts that came out of this, Juliet, was that Carl, within probably a month or 6 weeks, in fact, I still have a vivid image of waking up on the Haida bed at my parents' living room, where I was sleeping that summer, with a sense, such a strong sense that I had just been visiting with Carl, that I literally started crying and had this, oh no, we weren't just together. He's been dead for weeks. And it was very confusing, you know. It was, what, as you call it, it was clearly, I understand now, it's called an after-death communication.
There you go.
But
yep.
Carl showed up in my dream, and he was, you know, he was fine. Not only was he fine, he had a beard, and he couldn't, we used to tease him because he really couldn't grow in a beard very well. It was pretty sparse. So he would, like, he looked older, and he was saying, yeah, I've got all these things that I'm doing now for spirit, you know. I've got all these other things I'm up to, but I just want you to know that I'm better than good.
Ooh.
So don't feel sorry for me. You know, I came here to do what I came to do. I'm done. Everybody in my life who knew me has had and is having their experiences around my leaving the way I did, and it's all part of the dance. It's all part of the great passion play. And know that I love you, and know that I'll always be with you, and I'll be back to visit again. And just, you know that it's good, man. You can, you know, carry on. And he said it with a lot of love and a lot of care, and I woke up from that dream. I was like, oh my God. And so, you know, even though I had this experience of the Akashic Records, and I'd had these amazing, very powerful, you know, out-of-body experience and just different things that had happened through the use of LSD, now I was beginning to have experiences that were very spiritual and profound without any drugs at all. And I was, aha, this is the direction I'd like to go in. It also was pulling me out of, I had grown up, my father's mother tried to scare me into being a Christian.
That's a good way to put it, too.
Just terrified. I mean, absolutely terrified me as a little boy. And finally, my parents, who were trying to keep us away from churches in general, because they were both rebelling from strict Christian upbringing, started taking us to a Unitarian church.
Oh, that's great.
And so that was my, you know, I was involved in the Unitarian church up all the way through high school, and that was my introduction to spirituality. So I was aware that there were other things going on in the world, other perspectives, and of course, being a hippie, we were already, you know, doing or talking about yoga and meditation and the East and Buddhism, and, you know, this is already part of our world when I was, you know, 17, 18. We were already into that stuff. The Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, all that stuff. Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, all of these people were espousing these different spiritual perspectives, very eclectic. But I had been an atheist. I was an avowed atheist because I was one of those people who, you know, how could a loving God create this world with all its suffering? You know,
that's
one of the most common questions.
Oh, boy, you took the words right out of me, Mark. That's exactly what I was going to say. That I just hear that straight across the board all the time.
Yep. So it was out of that atheistic kind of hating what I thought was religion, what I thought was spirituality. It's just, you know, you got to be able to be in your five senses and be here now and da-da-da-da-da, you know, that whole story. And then I had this experience, I had this series of experiences, starting with the out-of-body experience, Carl dying, and then dealing with, finding a way to come to terms with this after-death communication with Carl. And it wasn't just one. He came back several times.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask about. And was it, I know that you were talking about having these lucid dreams. Did you have other forms of the ADC where you would just look and see him standing there, or was it mostly through the dream state that he came to you?
I would say it was really, it was that my experience at the time was that it was the dream state.
Okay. And I want to point out that all of this is valid. It doesn't matter how one appears, but it's interesting to get the, you know, to find out about the different ways that one will appear. Because I really want to encourage our listeners too that there's a myriad of ways that one can have an ADC, and that they are all very, very valid.
Right, and I have certainly had any number of them in the years since. It's just that I just want to, again, be real authentic, that at the time, summer of 68, they were through my dreams.
Okay.
With Carl, quite specifically.
Dreams are a very common way and an easy way for someone on the other side to reach us, because there aren't the barriers that one will experience in the so-called waking state. And so this is why I like to talk about this, because there are a number of powerful messages and encounters that do take place in the dream state. And when people understand that it's not just something going on with neurons firing off in the brain, you're actually experiencing other dimensional planes of your own existence and interacting with people on the other side, because you also in the dream state are somewhat out of body, and a lot of people don't realize, you know, and unfortunately there's been a lot of, oh, that's just a dream, that's not real. Well, phew, nothing could be further from the truth. So I really like to point out the substance of the dream is real. And there is a difference between what we are processing, like when we're processing things, the events of a day or something like that, versus having these encounters with other beings in the dream state. So this is really powerful, and I'd venture to say that your dreams were very lucid and felt as real and as tangible as anything that you would experience on the physical plane. Am I right about that?
Oh, without question.
Okay.
I really, my dreams over the decades have been a significant source of my coming to a much deeper understanding, at least for me, of the, you know, a bigger picture. And so dreams are kind of a window for me into a much larger world. I mean, I think many of us know that we're beautiful diamond faceted sparks of God in human form. We're God in form, having lives. We're spirit having a body.
There you go.
And this spiritual plane or spiritual planes are so much larger than the earth. There's so much going on, and there's so many different ways that people language this, that they talk about it. They have different stories or contexts in which they speak their experience. And that with my book, Drunk with Wonder, I'm another, a window, if you will, another vehicle. I went through such a long period in my life of struggling with addictions, and I'd stop one. I mean, you know, I stopped smoking after 10 years and, you know, one thing and another. And I kept finding these other really strong desires. And I'd get into snorting coke in the 80s, 70s and 80s. And I'd get into this and that. You know, I was a big coffee freak and, you know, so on and so forth. And I finally got to the point where I was able to ask the question, what's underneath all this stuff? Because it was, you know, dealing with addictions on their own, like going to one of these places where you dry out and, you know, get some therapy and so on, for 30 days. If you're not addressing the core issue, that's why recidivism is so high. It's because you're not dealing with what's really going on. You're just going, well, I shouldn't drink anymore, so I'll just stop drinking. You know, John Bradshaw, the famous author and speaker, said that, you know, he quit drinking, and then he was a dry drunk and an angry drunk, an angry dry drunk. but he hadn't dealt with his feelings or his emotions or the emotional wounds that were kind of what had been driving him to drink in the first place. So he was still a really angry, kind of vicious, critical person. Not a lot of fun to be around. And so my path has been to find a way to wholeness, to embrace all of me, the shadow and the light, to see that outside of what we call duality, God is, and only God is, and to find some way to come to compassion, to see my own path, see the choices that I've made in my life with love and forgiveness, to see that I was doing the best I could. And that obviously, I am supposed to be here, because there have been 100 different times I could have died.
Oh, I can say the same thing for different reasons, but indeed the same thing.
Yeah.
And so I still marvel at that.
Isn't that something? Well, clearly, you know, you have a gift that you're sharing with the world, with your Toward the Light work. And I know you're a musician, and that you share some of your gifts in that way as well. And you share with the radio show. And I think that's it's really clear that, and I want to say this for everybody listening, that no matter where you are in your life, you have gifts to share with the world. And they're important gifts. They're precious gifts.
Oh, that is such a powerful statement. And thank you so much for saying that, because it's very, very true. And we all need to be reminded of that, especially in a time of such uncertainty, where people are feeling very lost and frightened, you know. And it's so important, and I really want to address this too, and you've done beautifully in bringing this up in your book about listening to this sacred voice that comes from our higher self, and the fact that we are, I point this out all the time, and I've written about it in my blog as well, is that we are all a part of all that is, and we can't ever be separate from that. And that through this voice, we are always in touch with Source and being guided, and we need to learn how to listen to that and trust in it, because we're going to need to use that more and more all the time. And I remember having lots of traumatic experiences in my own life, and if it hadn't been for listening to that voice, I would not be here right now. I can assure you of that. So that's a very powerful message there. Continue, love. This is wonderful. I'm so appreciative of what you're sharing, and I'm sure our listening audience are very appreciative as well.
Well, thank you very much. Let's see.
I know it's also very emotionally charged, especially, you know, in the heart, because of you know, all the losses, but the consequential gains. You know, everything that happens to us in our life is a gift, even though it may not seem like one in the moment.
I couldn't agree more. And I finally, one of my relatively recent, let's say in the last 10 or 15 years, spiritual practices is to be able to look at any situation that I find myself in and specifically ask the question, where's the gift?
Yes.
Where is the gift? Some of the times they're easy, some of the times they're much more challenging. For example, when I've had quite a few friends and relatives die in the last few years. And so one example of looking for the gift was the day my father died, which was not quite 2 years ago. It was a late January day, and we had missed his actual passing by just a few hours. He went a little quicker than they thought he was going to. So we weren't actually there then. And I was feeling actually a lot of gratitude for his passing, because he had been in a facility for 3 years and had become violent and combative, and then had become completely motionless and, you know, completely helpless. And most of the times that I visited him, I detected absolutely no sense of him at all. I guess there was some kind of a tendril, but they really felt as though he'd left the building and had forgotten to take his body.
Yeah, and that happens as well. It really does. And being in a comatose or near comatose state, and this happened to me as well during my transcendent NDE in the mid-70s with cancer, that will be, still be tethered to the body, but it's kind of like a kite or a balloon, you know, still very detached from the body, but connected by that silver cord or tether or what have you. So what you're describing really makes sense, absolutely.
So anyhow, he finally was able to release his body. And I've been working, by this point, I had been working for years very assiduously on dealing with emotions, learning to understand them, learning to understand mine, peeling away the layers of the onion of my different stories and different wounds, so that they, because, you know, love brings up everything unlike itself for healing. And so the more spiritual work we do, the more stuff we're going to be stirring up.
Oh,
it's
boy.
It's a natural part of the process. I'm sure you're very aware of it.
Oh, yes.
And so I had been grieving my father for years already. I mean, literally. I had, you know, he knew he was going south. He'd been in hospice for a year. I had the great good fortune of hooking up with the community. We do lots of workshops with an emphasis on healthy emotional expression and healing and sharing with each other in this community. And so I had done some profound grieving work. So on that day, my overwhelming emotion was relief, like relief from my father, because I had no sense that I was any farther away from him than I had been when he'd been in his body. In fact, he felt much closer.
I was just thinking, yes, I'm sure he was indeed closer, because there weren't the barriers anymore.
Right, there was no part of him that was dealing with the pain and the confusion and, you know, and that sense of fear. I had it's just as clear as a bell, the vision of him meeting up with his mother and father and his brother Oren and other people who'd already passed on, welcoming him. I mean, this was just, you know, duh, of course, of course, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was really, and yet, you know, I'm with all four of my brothers and various spouses and niece and nephew and, you know, his grandkids I'm close with, and my mom, of course. And just towards the end of this January day, I just took a break and walked outside. Stood there, and there was this just ridiculously beautiful sunset.
Wow.
I mean, it was like take three really nice sunsets and wrap them all up, and this is this sunset. And my first thing was, hi, Pop.
Wow.
Hey. And I cried, and I wrote a poem, I wasn't feeling sad. I was feeling very intensely. I was feeling my father very intensely and feeling so many gifts and so much gratitude and so much appreciation for him and for life. And, you know, the most obvious gift, I think, whenever anyone passes is perhaps to just be ever more vigilant, present, aware that each moment, each breath, each heartbeat is such a gift. And to not wait until tomorrow to tell the people you love them. To not wait till tomorrow to take a few minutes and go out. I know this is a cliche, but hey, we have some peace roses blooming in our garden, so go out and smell them. Go out and just give thanks.
Absolutely. In fact, last night, speaking of sunsets, oh goodness me, I was walking along the lake here because I live next to a lake, and I beheld the most glorious sunset as you did, and I just kept saying, wow, wow. I couldn't stop saying wow. I was so in awe of this intensely beautiful, stunning sunset. And I could feel the love coming from it. It was just really, really special. And then I remember several weeks ago, I was walking, I think I was walking with my daughter along a road in Providence, Rhode Island, when we were there. And we were looking at some flowers and admiring them, and I heard some people across the street say, yes, that's what they do. They admire the flowers. And I thought, I love being noted for that. I love it when people remember us as doing something like that, because it's so important to do that. We really do get to connect with Source by taking the time to do that. And to have this, you know, this childlike sense of awe and wonder is so special. And I think that's also why I resonate so much with your book, with the title of your book and the contents too, by the by, because of that really pure place of feeling that wonderful awe. And also, getting back to your father, I think it's very much like what you feel when somebody graduates. You know they're moving on to something else, and yet there are going to be the tears and the reminiscence and all of that sort of thing. But he just was so clearly opened up. And another point that I would like to make, because I remember getting a question about this. Somebody was asking about the fact that her mum had Alzheimer's and saw a picture, a wedding picture, and her mum said, who is that, not recognizing her own husband. So the question was, would the person remember her husband when she crossed over, or if she had a near-death experience? And my answer to that is absolutely yes. Because, and I think this was the same with your father, that only his damaged brain couldn't perceive and understand things, but when he was out of body, he was his clear, conscious self, and he was able to connect and communicate very easily. And were you having that experience? Is that what you perceived as well with your father just before he crossed?
Absolutely. I was just thinking as you were speaking of that, how clear it is to me, and I know to many others as well, that we are not our bodies.
No, indeed.
We have bodies, and they're great vehicles, and they're wonderful to treasure. They're amazing temples. And who we really are is completely unaffected by what happens to our bodies.
Exactly. And that's such an important point to make, because we're still dealing with people being plagued with the fear of death. And I think the more that we can communicate these truths that, we are not our bodies, and the brains are not the broadcasters, they're just the receivers. The brains are not the radio towers or the broadcasting station, they're just the radios. And radios get damaged, but the signal still happens. And so I'm really appreciating what you're sharing here with Carl and with your father, because they clearly reached out to you, and you responded, which is equally as important as well, is to be aware and to trust in that communion that you were having with them. So go on, this is really special, Steve. I'm really loving what you're sharing here. And what happened after that?
My father's passing?
Mm.
Well, in a sense, a somewhat similar and by now familiar process of having a whole series of dreams where he, again, that we were visiting. In fact, I had one just this last summer that was so remarkably vivid, I awoke out of the dream in tears of gratitude. We were sitting in a room, and a couple of my other brothers were there, and we were all perfectly aware that Father had all of his experiences and all those tough times and had passed away, and that now he was back. And he was radiating so much love and gratitude and appreciation for his boys. He always adored his boys. No matter how hard he was on us, he was doing the best he could.
And how many of you? I'm trying to remember. Five, six?
I'm the oldest of five boys.
Whew.
Yeah, a handful. But in this dream, Juliet, I got to sit. I was sitting right next to my father, and we had our arms around each other, and we were looking in each other's eyes, and we were both crying. We were both grinning. And there was this, we weren't really talking in words, but there was this whole exchange of, you know, that was a bitch, wasn't it? Whoa, that was tough going through that one. Oh, my God, you know. And here we are now, and I'm back, is what he was saying. I'm back. I'm here. I never left. I'm always here. I'm always right here for you. We're always connected at the heart. And I'm really, really good. In fact, you know, some of the, this is one of the things I really want to share with your listeners too, is that, and again, this is my experience. I understand that some people have other experiences, and I certainly respect and appreciate that they have them. But what I get is that, see, one of the things that happened to my dad, he had a very strict upbringing. His father, my grandfather, was very tough, disciplinarian, very, today you would call him cruel, you would call him an abuser. Then it was just discipline. And he, my father, found himself in Germany on the front lines as a forward artillery observer in the spring of 1945 at the age of 19. Just like a lot of these boys today, boys and girls today, just kids, really just kids.
Yes.
And he was absolutely damaged by that time and would never speak of it. I mean, he just never. He just held it in and kept it inside, and it festered, and it showed up, and it blew up on my mom and on us boys. And mostly that's really all it ever blew up on, because he didn't feel safe to blow up on anybody else. But that's a lot of what my book is about these incredible emotional wounds that we carry around that fester. And that while we're taught to cope with them and to use various substances to keep them at bay, and we are the most heavily medicated society on the planet, if we really wanted to lower our medical bills, we would actually deal with these issues rather than popping pills or having a cocktail. Again, but I want to get back to the point here is that in this dream with my father, he was free of those traumas, just as he was free of the brain that was all riddled with dementia and Parkinson's. He was free of the traumas of war and the traumas of his father, and was his pure, essential self outside of so many of the stories. The story that was we were still sharing with each other was the story of father and son. We were also free, by the way, of a whole lot of our own trauma. Because there was a time in the 60s, you know, when I was a teenager, when I hated him. And I thought he hated me and went out of his way to screw with me. And so we had a very hard time there for a while. Long before, we healed all of that when I was in my 30s and 40s, when I started doing a lot of personal growth and spiritual development, I realized that one of the ways to demonstrate what I was learning was to spend time with my father and talk about these things and teach him how to hug and teach him to feel really loved, and to know that his love was safe with me.
That is very special.
So
wow.
We did that.
Yeah.
And so, as I said, this one of these key things that just really touches me so deeply is that in this dream, in this place where we were radiating love for each other, all of these, we knew that all of these stories had happened. It was like a movie. But we knew they couldn't touch us anymore. We knew they couldn't hurt us anymore or bother us or separate us anymore.
So you've also healed from the trauma. Yes, the traumas at the same time, it sounds like.
Yes, and I do a lot. That's one of my things and what I talk about quite a bit in Drunk with Wonder is we get to being intoxicated with life by becoming reacquainted with our passion. And our passion is not a thought, it's a feeling.
I really loved when you said that. Indeed, yes.
So that's, you know, the key to a fulfilling life to me, to living the richest possible life, is to be willing to go through the fire of feeling all the feelings that we have spent a lifetime avoiding. And I recognize that that can be very uncomfortable at times, and it is, but how uncomfortable is it to sit on a volcano all of your life, terrified that the least little slip and you're going to start spewing? How much fun is that?
Good point. Now, we've only got a few minutes. I'm amazed how quickly these hours fly by. Goodness me, but what was it that actually spurred the writing of this magnificent book? And by the way, I want to give out the website, which is the same as the title of the book, drunkwithwonder.com. It's a wonderful book. I'm so pleased to have this. What got you to writing it?
Well, you know, Juliet, I had been working on pieces of this for 15 years.
Mm.
And I had actually hired a friend, and he was helping me organize some of the different notes and dictations and different, because I've had a sense of channeling a voice.
Sure.
All the way back to 1991, and had transcripts from some of these events that we taped and so on, and was trying to figure out how to organize it, because I kept going, where do I start? You know?
Yeah.
So it happened actually June 15th of 2004. One of the dearest friends that I'd had in my life passed away quite suddenly at the age of 58. Developed pneumonia in the hospital. Long story, but
awesome.
It was just shocking. I mean, he was like the yoga teacher, the tantra teacher, the singer-songwriter, Sufi master. You know, I have this image of him with this big grin, and his teeth are green from blue-green algae. You know, I mean, just ultra super healthy, way healthier than me, way stronger, way fitter. I just, you know, anyhow. And he'd been a housemate for a while. And just he, in many ways, really helped get me on this path of emotional literacy and emotional healing, and where I am today. And so the day he passed, I had a lot of tears, and I had this really. I was out for a walk when he actually died, as it turned out, and I knew he was in bad shape, and I was just praying for the highest good. And that if he was supposed to leave his body, if he was done, you know, to know that that was perfect.
And indeed perfect. That's just what I was thinking. Indeed.
So I'm walking along on my walk, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I have this incredibly intense image. Robert was a Maui boy, you know, lots of time in Maui. And I saw him on the back of a dolphin.
Aww.
With one hand on a fin and the other hand just kind of yippee, kind of like a cowboy.
Yeah.
With this big yahoo. And I thought, oh, wow, that was a cool image. You know, it brought tears to my eyes. And I got back home and found that he had passed just at the time I'd had that vision.
Wow. I was thinking that's probably exactly in real way where he was too, because we suddenly gained this freedom, and just with the thought we can be anywhere we want to be or manifest anything we want to, it's certainly a lot easier on the other side to do that. That's brilliant. My goodness.
Well, and he had a whole, a really powerful spiritual community with him when he passed.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of consciousness and intention, and people were singing really beautiful songs and touching him and telling him, you know, telling him how much he was loved and that he was going to, you know. It's a good way to die.
It really is. And another interesting point around all this, too, is that some people do choose to be alone or not have somebody or certain people present when they cross, like your father, for example, and then
right.
Other people are happy to have a whole group around them, and then they leave their bodies at that time. So you never know. It's really up to the individual soul. And so that's another thing that I like to encourage people. Don't fret if you're not present with a friend or loved one when he or she crosses over, because if you're not, then it's just not meant to be. And if you are, then that's what was needed as well. But it's all right either way. Again, it depends on the individual. So this happened in 2004, and then you were...
And that day, I was sitting here with this fellow, a good friend, talking about which direction to go in the book. He had kind of taken my material, and he was giving me a presentation about what he thought I might, the direction I might go. And it really wasn't feeling right to me. But I was just kind of, you know, I was just kind of stewing about it. And this day that that Robert passed, I was just like, I just woke up. There was just this place in me that just got really clear, and I went, oh, okay, this is how it's going to be now. And that was June 15th of 2004. By the following, you know, 6 months later, I had the very first rough draft of what
wow.
became this book. And then by the following August of 2005, I had 95% of it.
Well, it's really beautiful, and I like what it says on the front, because it seems quite apropos, really. It says, where conversations with God meet, what the bleep do we know? And it's a beautiful book. We're at the top of the hour now. I hate to say, but we'll have to have you back. This is so beautiful, but I really want to encourage our listeners, please, to check out Steve Ryle's wonderful book, Drunk with Wonder, which can be located at drunkwithwonder.com. Beautiful book. Steve, it's been so wonderful having you with us, and what a heartwarming conversation this has been, and definitely we'll have to have you back. You're such a dear, and I want to thank you so much for being with us. And you've been listening to Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is Reverend Juliet Nightingale reminding you that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please do remember, by all means, that only love prevails. We will talk to you next week for another transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. And join us then. Blessings and light to all.